Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States' assessment of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been problematic since the victory of Iran's revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reiterated the U.S.'s miscalculations regarding Iran. He said Washington thought with its terror assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani that all of his efforts would have been in vain. But the reality, he says, is that the opposite is true. The committed people of Iran are following and continuing his way more now than ever before. So at the end of the day, what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight out of Berkeley, Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator. And Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome you both to the program. Well, let's start this off in Berkeley. And Paul, your overall assessment, what is it all about, Paul? There's so much animosity that comes from Washington towards Tehran that even started, even leading up to the revolution, even before the revolution miscalculation. What is it all about in your perspective?
Marzia, I think there is what you can call a more global view and also a very short-term view. The situation actually at the time of General Soleimani's assassination was that, let's say, there was an opportunity that was spotted by the military, saying an opportunity for assassination, that is. And it means that they were, of course, watching his movements and preparing for the possibility of assassination. And the short-term view is that they presented that to Trump and to President Trump, and President Trump saw it as an opportunity for him. That is to say, he was not being presented very well in the press, and he decided that an assassination like this, regardless of its actual strategic value, would boost him in the polls and make him appear to be a hero, or at least become a hero in the press, if you will, on a very short-term basis. And he took it. He wanted the glory, if you will, as the United States would see it. But there is another.
Paul, what exactly does that mean? I mean, you say that basically he took the bait. He decided that's what he wanted. He wanted the glory. But the system in the U.S. is not really individual-based as such. Wouldn't you say, I mean, there's something extremely problematic, to say the least, about an entity that sits down and thinks that, oh, okay, so assassinating this general representing another country on a diplomatic mission is actually an opportunity. I mean, let's look at that side of things and what we're saying about that entity.
Well, that's the other side of what I was going to mention. That is to say that there's a larger picture, but on balance, it's very possible that, you know, there were equal sides on the issue within Washington's and the Pentagon's calculating as to whether they should do it or not. But the side that had a, let's say, a more calculating and long-term view realized that General Soleimani was a problem for the United States because he was eliminating the terror threat in the Middle East, and because he had negotiated with Putin and was important in persuading Putin to join the fight in Syria in a limited way at that time, and because he unified forces in the region and the views, and because he had the respect of all of that, and so in that sense, they wanted him out of the way for these reasons.
Okay. Stay with me, Paul. Yeah. Let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Elijah, in the early days of Iran's revolution, Washington continued to say that Imam Khomeini was going to die any day, and after he would die, then the revolution basically would be over. And we've seen so many different types of miscalculations along the way. And, of course, with the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, I want to talk about that aspect, that it really expected the resistance in the region to be stunted now, to basically to be impeded or to go in another direction by assassinating him. Of course, he was a very, very important figure. But as the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said today, with his assassination or his martyrdom, actually, support for the resistance has grown.
Thank you for having me. I think what really happened is we can't exclude the ignorance of President Trump and the team he had around him to inform him that removing or assassinating General Qasem Soleimani would deter the access of the resistance, would weaken Iran because everything is related to one man and one man only. And that's pure ignorance, really, because the axis of the resistance is made of several population who have decided to fight against the U.S. hegemony and dominance, and they want the U.S. forces outside of their country. Now, that is not depending on one man. It is the ideology, it is the country, it is the principle, and it is the fight behind the cause and not behind one single man. And when President Donald Trump assassinated Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the Daesh emir, he thought that Qasem Soleimani could be more or less the same thing at the same level, and he can get rid of him like he did with Abu Bakr Baghdadi without soliciting any reaction. And what he did in a moment when the color revolution was starting to pick up a little bit in Iran, where people in the street were destroying banks and official institutions, creating havoc in the country, burning gasoline station, etc. And the Americans, with their limited thinking, they thought we can create more, we can give more boost to this movement of the population that the Americans are behind, and we can cripple more Iran and submit it so it accepts the U.S. dominance, and it, at the end of the day, it aligns itself for what we want. This is why Donald Trump impose maximum pressure on Iran to cripple the population and submit Iran. So by assassinating unlawfully an envoy of Iran and an advisor to the Iraqi government in Iraq, in Baghdad, he thought that he can get away with it and it would be a simple act. He didn't realize that Qasem Soleimani boosted a new blood in the revolution in Iran, because we saw millions of people in Iran, but also we saw millions of people in Iraq. And that also helped the axis of the resistance to remember who is the enemy, and that the U.S. should be removed from the area, because the only thing it is doing is just killing, particularly a general who was the main force behind defeating ISIS in the Middle East.
What about that, Paul? I mean, Elijah said that there's ignorance there, especially dealing with Trump and those around him. But we're not just talking about the 4 years that Trump was president. We're talking about more than four decades of miscalculation in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is that about? I mean, what exactly does that mean? We have many strategists, all kinds of think tanks in Washington and beyond. So, your assessment of it.
Thank you. That's right on point, Marzia. And Elijah is absolutely right. There's one side of it that's based on ignorance. And it's being used by people in the state and adjacent to the state, who are the deep state, you could say, that are using this ignorance for their own purposes. And those purposes are partly, in fact, in large measure, the purposes, the Zionist purposes of the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But it's also part of and allied to a deep state that wants to impose by military force its domination of other countries, and other countries which are currently dominated by the United States and which have puppet regimes of the United States installed there are sort of left alone. They're not, you don't see the U.S. Destroying those countries except by exploitation. But the other ones, which insist on being independent, and Iran is certainly a nation that wishes to remain independent, has as does Syria and Iraq and Venezuela and North Korea and Nicaragua and Cuba and on and on. There are these that are considered problem states, problem countries that the United States has to deal with. And what the policy towards those countries has been, and still is, that these countries have to be taught a lesson. And at the very least, they have to be destroyed. If they won't submit, then they have to be destroyed as an example to other countries as to what happens to them. So this, and this is very much part of the Zionist thinking, which benefits the state of Israel by using the U.S. military to fight the perceived enemies of Israel. So those interests are very much allied with each other, and that's not a case of ignorance. This is a case of very deliberate use of military force, economic force through sanctions, so-called sanctions, and destruction. And this is a theory of how the United States can continue to remain in power throughout the world.
Well, Elijah, continuing on that theme, I mean, do you think that it is because of a lack of understanding about Iran that there still is so much animosity and the actions that are taken against Tehran? Or is it actually because they have a very, very good understanding of Iran and the possibilities of Iran and its support, not only support for the resistance, but actually being the leader of the resistance?
I can't say that the U.S. has a good understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, because we saw what the Americans did in Afghanistan after 20 years. We saw what they are doing in Iraq. They were asked to leave in 2011, and now they are asked and will be forced to leave. We saw what they've done in Syria. They're occupying a part of Syria, and they don't know what to do, to remain or to leave, and they really can't figure out what's the best solution. We see what they are doing in Lebanon, and yes, I agree with your guest about the element of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu at the time when Donald Trump wanted the support of the Israelis in his re-election. And actually, Donald Trump blamed Israel for not going to war against Iran. Well, the Israelis are much more clever than the Americans at that time, because they know what the cost of with the confrontation, a military confrontation with Iran, and what would be the consequences and the cost. Well, I think the Americans, everything they have done in the last decade was a total failure. From the beginning, when they say we're going to Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, they haven't been able to do that, to destroy Taliban. They negotiated with the Taliban, who are back in power. They say in Iraq they want the weapon of mass destruction. What they have managed to contribute in the rise of a resistance that is part of the axis of the resistance that was directed its strength and its attack against the U.S. forces. Now in Syria, it's picking up. In Lebanon, they were kicked out in the 80s. And now they're trying to come back with the sanctions. So I don't see any clever policy of the U.S. apart from an elephant in a china shop, just breaking left, right, and center, and then leaving without even saying, I'm sorry, and say, well, what I have destroyed is only the consequences and of what I have done, and you can live with it, because there is no accountability. This is why the Americans can do what they are doing, because they fear and consider they have no consideration to international law, and they have no consideration to any law whatsoever, because there is no accountability.
Well, Paul, your take on what Elijah said as far as the United States not having any accountability, I want to look at overall how this miscalculation, whether we're talking about with Iran or Afghanistan or Lebanon or Syria or so many examples that Elijah just brought, what has it done to the United States itself?
Well, I don't think you'll find many people in Washington that will admit to a miscalculation, and that includes the think tanks and the part of Washington that studies very carefully what's going on and so forth. But there's a lot of disagreement between the forces in Washington, and there's also a lot of arrogance. So you and I may call it a failed policy, but the
if we just take Afghanistan, I mean, 20 years and how much money spent and leaving the way they did, I find even very few Americans would say that was successful policy that they adhered to in Afghanistan with the results if we look at it.
Yes, that's what they would say, but that's not what they say in Washington. What they say in Washington is that this is time well used, because the influence of what's going on in Afghanistan, it gave them a presence in the Middle East, and it pushed and it gave a warning to adjacent countries, don't mess with us, and all this kind of thing. This is the way they think. This is what I'm telling you. I'm not saying it's a good way of thinking. Right. I'm saying that this is the so-called expertise that they have there, and they would say, yes, we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve in Iraq, but on balance, it's still very useful. And as long as there's war going on and there's a war economy in the United States and the United States can destroy anybody on the face of the earth, we're in a good situation. That's the kind of thinking you're dealing with.
Okay. Elijah, we just have about 1 minute. Your overall assessment, I mean, the United States, especially after the assassination of General Soleimani, many would say that the reputation, whatever was left of it, has deteriorated rapidly. Your analysis of the United States right now in the region compared to prior to the assassination, how it has deteriorated, and where do you see it going from here?
I think the assassination of Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani brought something new to the Middle East. Soleimani's death is more feared by the U.S. than when he was alive. And I think this has raised the awareness to so many people about what the Americans are doing in the area, in the Middle East, and what they are capable of, and how they think they can do whatever they want. And people are working to push the Americans outside the Middle East now as soon as is possible. And we see what's happening today in Iraq, where they are attacked every single day, just for the Iraqi to make a point and say to the Americans, just leave us alone. We can sort out our problems without your presence.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here. Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator out of Berkeley. Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us right here.
The last savior.
Oh, the savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be my.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is The Lost Savior. I'm your humble host, Zainab. The listeners, we had been analyzing the tricks that are being used by the false claimants of Mehdi, who say that they are attached to Imam Mehdi, ajallullah ta'ala farajah, or they themselves are Mehdi. Now, it's really important to know about these tricks, analyze these tricks, and to conclude, shall we believe in these tricks or not? And on that note, we have with us in our studio Dr. Murtaza Karimi, who is a PhD scholar in Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
Thank you for having me.
I would want to know, is there any other trick beyond these tricks we had been talking about in the previous episodes? Like, you talked about istikhara, you talked about Ariza, you talked about miracles, and you talk about dreams. And interestingly, there were some of the tricks which do not have a base in the narrations as well, not even in the weak narrations. Now I want you to expand on the same topic.
The next one is that we know that based on the narrations both in Shia and Sunni sources, Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is one of the progeny of the Prophet. He is one of the offsprings of the Prophet. This is mentioned both in Shia and Sunni sources. He is one of the offsprings of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. Again, this is mentioned in both Shia and Sunni sources. And according to many narrations, he is the son of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. Of course, here some Sunni scholars believe that he is the son of Imam al-Hassan, alayhi salam. But, we have discussed that in one of the previous episodes. If there is any narration referring to the name of Al-Hassan, it is referring to the name of Imam Al-Hassan Al-Askari alayhi salam, and not Imam Al-Hassan Al-Mujtaba, the second Imam. But the point is that, at the end of the day, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is what we call a Sayyid. He is one of the offsprings of Hashim and one of the offsprings of the our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. Now, in the history of Islam, those false claimants who were not Sayyid, all the people knew that they are not Sayyid. And they tried to forge and make up a kind of family tree, or what we call it, Shajar-e-Name, to prove that we are Sayyid, so right. that they can convince the people that I am the promised Mahdi. Because if you are not a Sayyid, then all the people would reject you. Because all scholars, all Muslims, unanimously agree that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is a Sayyid.
And in order to prove that you are a Sayyid, you need to have a thing called a Shajar-e-Name or a family tree.
Yeah, this is one of the ways, of course, that family tree should be authentic and it should be confirmed by the scholars. There are some conditions. If I have time, I may explain about them, inshallah, right. later. Again, we see that some of the false claimants who were not Sayyid, they used this trick. They just deceived the people by claiming that we are Sayyid, and one of the ways was just to forging a family tree.
All right, Dr. Karimi, we'll be talking to you. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. Morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand year old pain.
We have a person, for example, in the history of Islam, his name is Muhammad bin Ubaidullah, who passed away in 524. He claims that I'm an offspring of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. Next, we have Sheikh Muhammad bin Ahmad Faryani. Again, he went from Qahira to Nablus, and he was a judge. And later, he claims that I'm a Sayyid, and I'm the promised Mahdi. So we're not going to talk about them, because they have passed away and people came to know that they are not the real Mahdis. In the contemporary time, we have a movement which happened a few decades ago in Saudi Arabia, of course, for a couple of days only. There was a man whose name was Muhammad bin Abdullah Qahtani. He passed away in 1400 after Hijrah, about 43 years ago in Saudi Arabia. He claims to be the promised Mahdi, and together with another person, Juhayman al-Utaybi, they made a kind of uprising, armed uprising in Masjid al-Haram, and then it was suppressed by the Saudi government. Now, the point is that this Muhammad bin Abdullah Qahtani, although the name Qahtani means that he belongs to that tribe and he's not a Sayyid, but to deceive his followers, he says that I'm from the people who are known as Shurafa. Shurafa is referring, is one of the titles used for the Sayyid. I'm one of the Shurafa who migrated to Egypt and later went to Yemen, and that is why we became known as Qahtani. So the point is that I was a Sharif, I was a Sayyid, later I came to be known as Qahtani. So this is the way that he tried to
prove that he is a Sayyid.
Exactly. Again, these two people have passed away, and people, I mean, few
came
followers
to know that they were not Mahdi at all.
But the alive case, again, is that false claimant from Basra. Again, he says that I'm a Sayyid. According to his claim and the claim of his followers, they say that he is the son of a person called Sayyid Ismail, son of Sayyid Saleh, son of Sayyid Hussein, son of Sayyid Salman, and that Sayyid Salman is the son of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So through four intermediaries, this false claimant claims that I'm one of the offsprings of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. What is their arguments? In some of the books, they say that this genealogy can be proved only through Allah and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and lay people cannot understand it.
Wow.
Yeah. This is one way that they try to justify and explain this
and
claim.
That way I am a Sayyid too.
Me too. In another book, this false claimant himself says that my name and my genealogy has been mentioned by God and the Imams. Not only that, different prophets have introduced me at their time, like Daniel, like Ermia, Isaiah, all these prophets, they have introduced me at their time, and now you are forsaking me. So, having said that, we would like to know, Islamically speaking, what are the ways to prove that a person is a Sayyid? First of all, according to Sayyid Yazdi in Urwat al-Wuthqa, the main reasons to prove a person to be Sayyid or not, some of the Islamic laws are related to a person being a Sayyid or not. When it comes to Khums and Zakat, we know that Khums is paid to the Sayyid, but Zakat is not, cannot be paid.
Paid to Sayyid.
So it's very important for us to know whether a person is a Sayyid
or not.
So according to Sayyid al-Yazdi in Urwat al-Wuthqa, one of them is bayyana, a proof. You need to bring a very authentic proof to claim that I'm a Sayyid. And second of all, when all the people, it is widespread among the people generation after generation that you are a Sayyid. And maybe in the most cases, this is how it works. The reason that we believe in some people today as Sayyid, it is because of the fact that their fathers and forefathers were famous as Sayyid, and then the previous generation was also known as Sayyid. So it is something mashhur or famous, widespread among the people that the members of this family are Sayyid. And the other way, according to some scholars, is family tree, but it should be approved by a special scholar. Some of the scholars, they are expert in genealogy and family trees. So if you want to claim that I'm a Sayyid through a family tree, you need to have the
stamp and signature.
Exactly, an approval of those scholars who are expert in this field.
Hold me by your hand and please show me the way to be one of the pure and chosen companions, so that I can swear the oath of allegiance. I'll give everything that I love in God's name to avenge the blood of your grandfather Hussein. Every step of the way my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh Master, I'll call out to you. O light of Allah, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Now, when it comes to these false claimants from Basra, none of these ways can be found. Not only that, people have found the relatives of these false claimants in Basra. And interviews has been done with the members of the same family and tribe, and the real And the true family tree of this person is that his father is Ismail, then Saleh, then Hussein, then Salman, then a person called Dawood, which has nothing to do with Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And it goes, and finally it reaches to a person, Ahmed, and none of them is Sayyid. So, as I mentioned, let me also refer to the name of his tribe. His tribe is named as Hambush, which is one of the tribes of Al Abu Suwaylim, and no one in these tribes has ever claimed that, I mean, we are Sayyid.
We are Sayyid.
So he's the first person in his family to have claimed that I'm a Sayyid. Okay. Even his brothers, I mean, and other members of his family, they have testified that we are not Sayyid. The family tree of our family is very clear, and it doesn't go back to Imam Mahdi, it doesn't go back to any of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, so we are not Sayyid. So again, to give a summary of what I mentioned in today's session, one of the tricks used by false claimants is that when they are not Sayyid, they try to forge some family trees and to claim that they are the offsprings of one of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, Imam Mahdi or any other Imam, because if they are not Sayyid, then no one would believe in him. But for people who want to check whether they are telling the truth or they are liars, they need to go and find the truth through the ways that I mentioned, like a family tree which is approved by scholars, or the fact that they are known by all the people as Sayyid. Otherwise, again, we need to reject such people.
All right, so we had been talking about, first of all, have you proved that you are a Sayyid? You need to have a family tree that is attested by the authentic scholars. And apart from that, you need to, people must know you, like your family members should accept that, or your forefathers should be Sayyid. And in case of these claimants who claim to be Mahdi, we neither saw an authentic family tree, nor did we saw any family members saying that they had been Sayyid. In fact, their family members were interviewed who told that we have no connection with Sayyids, we are not Sayyids. Not going very far away, even the brothers and sisters of this false claimant said that they are not Sayyids. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us on the show. Inshallah, we'll see you next time in next episode. Until then, this is Zainab Askari with her whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. 82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions. Vaccine hesitancy and scepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They said they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week, he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now, you see. A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now, they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increased the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange.
Qasemi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the Yellow Vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. For hundreds, sometimes more, this bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway, due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outburst, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country. On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000. And overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million.
We take things lightly, as usual, and we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious.
Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in 5 key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors and health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds, graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, 3 times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. U.S. medical centers are already overwhelmed and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the US, already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S. and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation.
adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Hamoud was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Purizza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abu Latif Bashali, Sana'a.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners at